Steve, yeah. Steve Lamb, alcoholic. Yeah, Barkley leaves crap everywhere he goes. It's just, it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. And I wanna thank the committee again. My wife got the flowers yesterday. And, that was really, really sweet. But you kinda screwed it up for me. On a going forward basis, this might be a little grim, but it really is greatly appreciated. It's unique and it's wonderful, and I loved it, and my wife loved it. And thanks, Darren, for a great talk last night and this morning. I really enjoyed that a lot. And we've all decided that Barkley can't get drunk. He can't, because nobody can do what he does. I mean, no one would even try. And I mean, we're weird. We're all weird, but Barkley just takes it to a whole nother level. You know? And you do that, my friend, to make us all feel normal. And I want you to know that we appreciate it, okay? And I enjoyed my friend Bill's meditation this morning. I think it's interesting that somebody came up to him before that and thanked him for the talk that I gave last night. And as his way, he said, "You're welcome." And if you're new and you're thinking, "Oh my God, that talk about meditation was so brilliant and beautiful and lovely." And it really was. But I want you to know, if you're new, there's hope. Because when I first met Bill 25 years ago, his idea of meditation was to sit on the crapper with a 24-hour-a-day book and read it. Okay? It's called a transformation, gentlemen. And sometimes it takes some time. And that's one of the things I want to talk about today. We want to talk about amends. For a while. And amends is, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. This isn't a novel concept. You know, the Bible says, you know, before you go to the altar, first make restitution. First be reconciled to your brother. This is not a novel concept, making amends. But if you're like me, you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you're thinking, "Oh man, you know, I've admitted I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life is unmanageable. I've done this stuff. I've written an inventory, but really, do I need to make amends?" I mean, it really seems a bit drastic, right? And I understand the concept. I understand it's their money. I do. I understand it's their money. But some of them don't even know I've got it. Right? And how is me giving them their money going to help me stay sober? It doesn't make any sense. But it's a critical part, in my view, of the transformation process. And one of the things that happens at retreats like this is guys like me get up and get to share our experience with something, which may or may not match your experience. Okay? This is certainly my opinion, but it's based on my experience. Again, you're here to have your experience, not my experience. I believe that amends is the fulcrum that launches us into the spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening, the psychic change, whatever you want to call it, that reorientation of the way we think and perceive the world around us. And I believe it's critical, and a lot of people don't do it. You know, I go to a lot of retreats, I talk to a lot of guys, it's not uncommon to have somebody say, particularly in relation to meditation, "I can't meditate. You know, I got a really busy mind. I got a lot going on up there." And I'll often ask them, "Well, have you made your amends?" "Well, yeah, most of them." "Really? Okay. What if I were to say to you, I would like you to bake a cake. I'm your sponsor, and I'm asking you to bake a cake." So you run to the store and you get a cake mix box, right? And you gotta get the ingredients. You gotta get some eggs and you gotta get some oil. You have to have some water. You have to grease a pan. You gotta follow the instructions in order. You call me after a few hours. You say, "Hey, Lamb, I got a cake. Come on over and see my cake." So I come over to your house and I look at the cake, and it's this flat, it looks like a elongated piece of cookie. I don't know what it is. It doesn't look like a cake. It's brown. It looks like it's been baked. And I say to you, "Well, did you follow the instructions?" And you say, "Oh, yeah, I did." "All the instructions?" "Well, yeah, pretty much all the..." "All the instructions?" "Well, I'm not an egg guy. I don't really like eggs." Okay, so you didn't follow all the instructions. You didn't put in all the ingredients in order the way it's outlined. You didn't follow the steps as directed in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not doing your amends, you haven't meditated, but you're saying it's not working because you haven't followed instructions. Now, a lot of people don't like to hear that, but that's the truth. And the reality is, the bizarre thing is, when you talk to that guy, often he believes he's followed the instructions. Just like when I first got here and I sat my butt in a chair in AA, I'm thinking, I'm in AA, I'm doing AA. I'm not doing the steps. I have a lot of activity, but I have no action. My sponsor used to call it, I was like a dog on linoleum. You know, there was a whole lot of activity, but I wasn't getting anywhere. Wasn't getting anywhere because I wasn't in action. And it's because of this concept of delusion. It's not that the newcomer doesn't agree with you. He doesn't see it the way you see it because he can't. He's under the same delusion that I was in when I got it. And I believe that I'm still under some delusions. Hopefully they're not as significant as the ones that I had when I first got here 25 plus years ago. But I know there's things that I think are real that are not real. They're not true. But I believe them. And we talk a lot about delusion and we talk about denial. And most people in AA talk about denial. You'll hear people come up to a podium like this and they'll talk about denial. We're in denial. Denial, denial, denial. That word appears only two times in the big book. In the first 164 pages, it appears on page 10 when Bill is referring to his grandfather, Fayette Griffith, who is denying the right of a preacher to tell him what God is. And then if you go to page 568, which is appendix 2, spiritual experience, it talks about you're denying the reality of God. You're belligerently denying the existence of God. So denial is, in the big book, only talking about our denial of God. It's not about denying that we're alcoholic. But that's how it's been transformed. But denial is really like a treatment center or rehab term. It's not like I don't suffer from denial. I have denial. But when I'm in denial, denial is, I know the truth. But I really like the lie. A lot. And I'm trying to convince you of the lie. Now you know the truth and I know the truth. But I'm trying to convince you the lie. Delusion is, I don't know the truth. And I think it's real. And it is much more dangerous than denial. The Dalai Lama once, in The Path to Tranquility, when he talked about delusion, he said this. Delusion is a state of mind that is very obvious. When it arises within the mind, it causes mental disturbances and anxieties in the individual. No kidding. Furthermore, it causes many problems and difficulties in society, often on a national scale. Right from the beginning of human civilization, delusions have been the real causes of problems, trouble, and conflict within society. It is delusion that forces one to be attracted and attached to one's own side and to feel hatred and anger toward the opposite side. Thus, one creates many divisions within the human community. All of these come about through the underlying force of the attachment to one's self. So what happens is I have an attachment. I have an attachment. And then that blossoms into a desire. Because I'm an alcoholic, it is never fulfilled, it's never enough. I suffer from the Goldilocks dilemma. I come in and it's either too hot or too cold. When it's just right, it's never enough. And I want more. And when you give me more, I tell you to back off because you're just crowding me. I'm just in this perpetual state of discontent. And that's alcoholism. You know, the big book talks about delusion. It says on page 30, the delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. On page 61, it says, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? And on page 62, it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. So we stop drinking, but how do we get through this delusion? One of the greatest analogies that I've ever heard about this, Chuck didn't do it a lot, but he did it in some of his talks. He did an analogy of I call it the dirty drinking water glass analogy. And what I mean by this is imagine yourself, you've been out on a run. It's been a really good run. Now, you've still got a place to live, but it's kind of beat up. You know, you're in an apartment or maybe a trailer, and you come out of your bedroom and you go into the kitchen area and the cupboards are all off the hinges. It's pretty dirty. It's pretty dank. It's pretty nasty because you've been living there for the last couple months and you've been on a wicked run. And you come to and you're just parched. You need to drink some water. You're just desperate to drink some water, and you stagger out to the kitchen area and you see that there's one glass on the counter, just one. And you look at the glass and it's kind of funky. It's got some black and green stuff in it because you've been drinking tequila out of it and whiskey. On a bad night, you might have had milk, you know, it was a misstep on your part, right? And you're looking at this glass. It's got some really funky stuff in it. So what do? Because you got to drink the water. So you reach into the silverware drawer and you get out a spoon or a knife and you dig into that glass and you dig out some large chunks of truth about yourself. And you flip them in the trash can or in the sink. And you look at the glass, but you still can't drink. So you turn on the tap water and you put it under the tap and you let the tap water run through the glass and it starts to rinse out the debris. It starts to clear out the glass. Now the glass never gets really totally clear, but it's water that you can drink. It's potable water. So you can drink that water. And more importantly, I can give the water to you to drink. Now I put the glass on the counter and I have to remind myself that I have to continue to rinse out the glass and do the work. Or I don't have water. I don't have living water that I can give you. There was some discussion last night and this morning about the 11-step prayer. The 11-step prayer, which is on page 99 of the 12 and 12. Lord, make me a channel. Lord, make me a channel. The religious version, the Catholic version of that, is Lord, make me an instrument. Both are perfectly good prayers. They're wonderful prayers. I was talking to Ba'an this morning, and Ba'an was telling me that he had, you know, in his morning meditation, he had gone over the 11-step prayer. It's a wonderful prayer, wonderful prayer. But the religious version is an instrument, not a channel. We talk about clearing the channel. Now, when I was new, I kind of wanted to have an instrument. Darren and I were talking about this earlier. It seems to me that at about 3 to 6 years of sobriety, I know stuff. You know, you don't even need to ask me. I'm going to tell you. You know, and I'm kind of overbearing about this. And it's actually kind of this wonderful evangelical stage of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I'm grabbing people, I'm throwing them in the car, and then I realize, oh God, apparently there's another way to do this. You know, one of my favorite things that I ever saw was I went out to Portland to give a talk, and they took me out to lunch, and then I went to a little clubhouse in Beaverton. And up on the wall, they had a poster that said, "We don't care how you did it in Southern California." And I always wanted to have an instrument. I kind of wanted to have my old grand sponsor, Scott Redmond, used to talk about, like, wouldn't it be cool to have a sober stick? Because newcomers don't pay attention. I'd want to have it padded. I wouldn't want to hurt them, you know, but I'd want to just smack them upside the head every once in a while just to get their attention. Right? But we don't do that. We're a channel, and we have to clear the channel. And how do we clear the channel? In 4 through 9. That's why the ninth step, the amends, are so important, so critical. Little historical note. June 10th, 1935, that's AA's birthday, right? It's not Bill's sober date. It wasn't even the date that Dr. Bob got sober. That particular morning, he apparently had a hooker of beer, which, by the way, if you're new, it's not a prostitute. Okay, it's just a small amount of beer. And he had a goofball, a barbiturate, to steady his nerves. Because what had happened was, about 3 weeks earlier, he'd had a conversation with a guy named Bill Wilson in the gatehouse on the Sieberling estate. And somebody spoke his language. And he realized, my God, I can get sober. I understand this guy. So he invited Bill to his home with his wife, Ann, and for about 3 weeks, he was sober. And they didn't have the steps back then yet. Bill hadn't formulated it, but they had the Oxford Group principles, and Bill talked about it a little bit. And one of those principles, a pretty critical principle, one of the tenets, and they refer to the tenets of the Oxford Group in the foreword to the second edition. One of the tenets was restitution, reparation, amends. But Dr. Bob, in his mind, he's like, I'm a prominent physician in the Akron area. This would adversely impact me, my profession, my family. I can't go around and, and acknowledge what I've been doing. I can't make amends. I can't make reparations. This wouldn't be good. Now, Dr. Bob was a proctologist. He was an anal surgeon, okay? But in his mind, he's thinking nobody knows. We all think nobody knows, right? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. But he did not make amends. And what he did was he went off to American Medical Association conference in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And he just got drunk as a skunk. And when he came back on the train, they rolled his butt off the train. He was totally wasted. But he's got to do anal surgery the next morning, which is a little on the delicate side, right? I mean, you want to have steady hands, you know, if your surgeon's going to be operating down there, right? And so they give him a beer and a goofball, and they send him off to do anal surgery, June 10th, 1935. And he's supposed to be back around 11 o'clock or noon, and depending on the historical reference that you look at, he comes back around dinner time. One of the historical references says it wasn't until midnight. He's gone all day. And that's back when they don't have cell phones, they don't have pagers, they don't have any way to get a hold of him. So Bill and Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, are just freaking out. They're pacing back and forth. They're like, oh man, I bet he's out there. I bet he's, because he's doing what we do, right? They expected he was out drinking. He was not out drinking. What Dr. Bob did was he went all around Akron on that day and he made amends. And he stayed sober until the day he died. He cleared the channel. So there seems to be a connection between that and long-term sobriety. I talked about my father last night, you know. I'm gonna tell you a few of the amends stories, basically from my personal experience. And I would encourage you during the weekend, particularly if you're somebody that's newer and hasn't yet made amends, talk to some of the men here that have been around a while, ask them about amends. This is something we really do, guys. This isn't theoretical. It isn't something that's in the book. It's something that has saved our lives. It's transformed our lives. It's allowed people like Bill C. to get off the toilet with a 12 and 12 and sit here and talk about a spiritual awakening in a way that we can understand because it happened to him. But you have to do the work to have the experience. So when I started to do amends, obviously the first amends that I wanted to make was to an ex-girlfriend. You're with me, right? You know, I mean, it seemed like the thing to do, right? And so I'm explaining to my sponsor, Michael, how I'm going to make this amends. And he's like, well, I think we ought to put her a little bit down on the list, number one. Number two, he says to me, he looks at me, he goes, you know, when we make amends to ex-girlfriends with our pants on. I'm like, what? He goes, look, I've heard what's going on. You know, I know what's going on with you. Because I was having a hard time with my wife. I mean, it was difficult. In fact, my sponsor had told me once you've done the steps, you know, you need to be ready, prepared to sponsor. You know, that's where it comes alive. That's where you'll have to sit down and read a big book with a guy. You'll have to explain to him the experience that you have had and are continuing to have in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where it comes alive. So I'm like, I'm ready. And then one day I got asked. And man, she was smoking hot. God. I'd given a talk and I thought it was a pretty good talk and we had locked eyes and I caught her attention and she came up to me after the meeting and she asked me to sponsor her. And I paused. I hesitated because I'd heard it's probably not a good idea. So I like, look, let me get your number. I want to talk to my sponsor about it, right? And I'm a lawyer, so I'm kind of smooth, right? I figure I'll just kind of smooth this right through it. I go to Michael, I say, hey, good news. I got asked to sponsor somebody. He goes, that's great. What's his name? So I detracted right away and explained about the meeting I was at and how I'd given this talk. And after about the third or fourth question, he goes, it's a woman, isn't it? I said, well, yeah. It's a coincidence, right? And he said, Lamb, I know you're having a hard time with your wife. And sex is important, particularly as you're younger. At my age, it's getting less significant. But at the time, it was pretty significant. He says, I tell you what, our local hospital here, Torrance Memorial, up on the ICU ward, I think it's on the fourth floor, just go up there maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I think there's some pretty good-looking women up there. Why don't you just go ahead and unhook them, have your way with them. And then before you leave, make sure you hook them up and kind of sneak out the back door, because that's pretty much what you'll be doing if you sponsor this woman.
I thought that was a little harsh.
Now, my sponsor never said, don't sponsor that woman. But I didn't sponsor that woman. Now, interesting coincidence is I now sponsor one woman. And this was about 7 or 8 years ago. This woman asked me to sponsor her, and I told her, well, I didn't really sponsor women. And she said, really? Why not? And I said, well, I'll get back to you on that. You know, I went and talked to my sponsor, and I said to him, I said, you know, this woman asked me to sponsor her, and I told her I don't sponsor women. He goes, oh, why is that? He goes, well, we had that conversation. He said, I never told you not to sponsor women. I just said, you know, what's your true intent? And my true intent was bad. He goes, what's your true intent here? I said, well, yeah, I'd like to help her. He goes, are you sexually attracted to her? No, not at all. And then he asked me a question. He said, what are you afraid of? What do you mean? What are you afraid of? So I had to think about that. I'd pray and meditate. I came back and I realized what I was afraid of is I was afraid what you'd think of me. That's what I was afraid of. And he asked me, is that sufficient enough, that fear, to warrant not helping another person? I said, no. So I've sponsored her now for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And frankly, she's more of a guy than a lot of you guys. I mean, she is just a rough one, you know. And it's worked out well. And it's worked out well. But, you know, I'm trying to make this amends stuff. And I remember I got this list. I talked about it last night. And one of the things that Michael said to me is he said, well, why do you want to make these particular amends? What do you mean? Why do you want to do, I mean, you've got a proposed amends here. Why do you want to do this proposed amends? I'm like, well, I don't really want to make the, but you told me I've got to do this. This is the, well, but what's the point of this? I'm like, well, I think if I make the amends that, you know, they'll like me, that it'll be okay, that the relationship will be restored. He said, well, is that the point of the amends? And if you've been around a while, you know it's not the point of the amends. The point of the amends is to try to make some reparation, to try to repair. I may get a benefit out of it. I may not. They may throw me out of the office. They may not. That's not the point. The point is to try to make restitution, to restore what I've taken from you, either monetarily, physically, spiritually, or relationship-wise. That's the point. And I had a hard time with that. He explained to me it's not about a bumbled apology. It's about a future and consistent demonstration. If you continue to do what caused you to make amends in the first place, it's a very, very crappy amends. So one of the amends that happened to me that was pretty significant was my wife. And in the book, you know, it talks a lot about how, you know, we've been wild. Maybe if should we tell her the specifics? Not necessarily. I'm thinking, well, absolutely not necessarily. And so I'm getting ready to make amends to my wife, and I talked to Michael. I'm like, well, what if she asked me questions? What if she asked me questions about what I did in Beirut in 1983? What if she asked me these questions? He said, well, I don't know. We'll deal with that when that happens. But right here, right now, you know, you just need to make amends. You need to stay on your side of the street. You need to acknowledge your wrong. And he advised me to say a little and allow her to talk. Which, as a lawyer, is not my natural state of being, right? And I was, it's funny, before I got up here, somebody asked me, you know, are you nervous when you talk? And I said, no. And by the way, that is not a character asset. It's a character defect. You know, I figure you invited me. It's your fault. I'm going to have a good time. You're on your own. You know, I don't know what to tell you. Okay. But I am nervous about making amends to my wife. And so I'd scripted it out. I had it on a card and I edited it a number of times. I get an opportunity and we're taking this walk and I'm just nervous. I'm just nervous as a whore in church. You know, I start mumbling and stumbling and I'm trying to talk. I'm trying to make amends. And my wife looks at me and she turns to me and she holds me by both shoulders and she says, Steve, I know what you're trying to do. I'm really glad you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad you're sober. I want you to keep doing what you're doing. But please, please don't tell me any of the details. And I remember thinking at that moment, apparently there is a God. You know. And we've had more subsequent conversations and we've gotten into some of the details, but there's a lot of stuff that she doesn't want to know. And I have to honor that. Probably one of the biggest amends that I made, and this was a very difficult amends to me, was to my daughter Ashley. My daughter Ashley was born with cerebral palsy and a seizure disorder. She couldn't walk. She couldn't talk. She ate through a feeding tube. She had seizures. She had these things called tonic-clonic seizures, which are just spasms. She'd have 20, 50, 100 a day. And periodically, she'd have a grand mal seizure. She'd seize up to the extent that she could not breathe, and they'd have to paddle her back and resuscitate her. And one of the many things that I'm not proud of, but it's true, is that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for some time after that, I was very resentful of my daughter. Now, a father's not supposed to feel this way. I know that. A father's not supposed to yell at his son and lock him in the room. But I did a lot of inventory on this, and I resented my daughter. In part, I think it's because I felt she was different. In part, I felt like maybe this was punishment that God was bestowing upon me because of all the bad stuff that I'd done. But I resented her. I couldn't see her for who she was. I didn't understand that I had an opportunity to love her. I viewed it as work, and I resented it, and it ate me up. And I knew I was just an awful person because of this, because fathers don't feel this way about their children. And I read inventory, and I worked with Michael, and I did some work with Scott Redman about this, and I made amends to my daughter. I made amends to my daughter. And a father was restored to a daughter, and a daughter to father, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time, because she was so medically fragile, she was in a facility down in San Diego at the Children's Hospital, and a beautiful facility, about 50, 60 beds, and we would go down there every weekend. I bought a conversion van so we could put the wheelchair in there, and we would drive down there, spend the weekend down there with her. I'd put her in a wheelchair, I'd brush her hair, I'd put a little balloon around her chair, and she would laugh and giggle, and it was just beautiful. And I loved my daughter, and it was really great. And I thought that this is a wonderful thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And then the first guy that I sponsored, a guy named Stephen, read his inventory to me. And the first person I had his inventory was his son Evan, that he resented, who had cerebral palsy and a seizure disorder. And what we did was we worked through these steps, which are just spiritual exercises that are designed to allow each individual to find, develop, and maintain a conscious contact with the God of his or her understanding, based on his or her experience, so that we could live and move and have our being in the world. And he did this. And a father was restored to a son, and a son to a father, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it was great. Everything was great. Till one day we got a call in the middle of the night. We got these calls pretty frequently, you know, several times a year. We got to go down to the hospital. Ashley's had a seizure. She's in ICU. I'm like, okay. We get in the car, drive down there. I go in to see my daughter. She's in the hospital room. You know, all the machines are going. She's got a bunch of tubes on her. She's hooked up to a bunch of stuff. And I went up to my daughter and I kissed her and I caressed her cheek and I told her, baby, it's going to be okay. And it was not going to be okay, because there was a doctor waiting in the room. And after we'd been there for a few minutes, he called my wife and me back and he said, your daughter's not going to make it out of ICU. I'm like, what are you talking about, doc? My daughter's tough. I mean, she was 19 at the time. This had happened, I don't know, tens of times. She's tough. She'll make it. She'll pull through. He's like, no, you don't understand. Your daughter's having renal failure. She's been on medication so long that her kidneys are shutting down, her liver's shutting down, and we ought to understand this because this happens to a lot of us. But because of all the anti-seizure medication, her system was just shutting down. Now, I'm praying and meditating quite a bit at this time, but I'm not having a good conversation with God. I'm pissed. You know, I'm talking to God. I'm like, God, how could you do this to me? I mean, I know I was a crappy dad. I got it. I was a crappy dad, but I've done the steps. I've done the work. I sponsor all these guys. I've made amends to my daughter. I love my daughter. How could you take her from me? And I'm reading this inventory to Michael, and I'm talking to Scott about it, and neither one of them said anything to me other than just keep praying and meditating, keep doing the work, the answer will come to you. They didn't tell me what they were thinking, thank God. 3 or 4 days into it, I come out of a meditation, and what I realize is that I've been selfish and self-centered. I'm not worried about my daughter dying as much as I am that I'm going to miss my daughter. I'm not concerned about her, and I realize my daughter, she can't talk. But when you hold her, she can convey what she's... It's hard to explain, but she can convey what's going on with her eyes. And she was exhausted. She was tired. She was ready to go. And my job was to be her father in this world and in the next. And I was just being selfish and self-centered. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to be there when my daughter passed. When she took her light into the next room. And that happened later for my sponsee's son, Evan. And we were there for Evan. And I got to tell you, this is just me, but what I've come to believe based on that and some other experiences, we are not simply a physical structure with fluid and bones and sinew and muscle and brain. We are more than that. There's something else. The religious called it the golden cord, the silver thread, that which binds me to you and you to me and us to God. Scott Redman used to call it the connective tissue of Alcoholics Anonymous. The connective tissue of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why when I listen to a fifth step, I relate to you. This is why that feeling of separation that doesn't exist, that sense of being outside the circle, that anxious apartness that the 12 and 12 refers to, that is total BS, evaporates when I'm with you. But, you know, a lot of these don't go particularly well. You know, and one of the reasons why I talk about these is because I want particularly the new guy to understand that, you know, it's not about the result. It's about the action. I remember when I made amends to my mom. I had specific instructions. I was just going to say a little and then listen, right? Because that was the deal. I went to my mom in Vegas and I started talking. She started talking. I started talking. She started talking. I started to tell her about all the transgressions that she had done against me. And I'm telling you guys, it was awful. I mean, you think Darren had it bad? My mom made me play cello. Okay? Cello. Cello. And my brother, who was a great musician, who was a guitar player, I wanted to be a guitar player, right? No. Tom's a guitar. You can't play guitar. How about the drums? No. What can I play? Cello. It's like a trumpet. A trumpet? It's nothing like a trumpet, right? And I hated the cello. And she made me play the cello, and I wound up being second string orchestra in the Las Vegas Philharmonic Orchestra at the age of 9. I was a child prodigy. I could write music. I hated it so much. And when I finally got to not do it, I can't even read sheet music today. And I hated my mother for that. And I told her. And I'm driving back to Vegas, and I'm thinking, well, that didn't go too well, you know? I talked to Michael. I said, I screwed up. I screwed up, man. I screwed up. He said, well, did you follow her? Yeah, I did. You had the note card? Yeah, I had the note card. He said, remember we talked about you were going to pray and meditate and ask God into the room before you did this? I said, yeah. Did you do that? I said, yeah, I did. He said, well, what happened? I said, I don't know. And she started talking. God split. I don't know. It was just really bad. So I said, look, I'll go back. I'll straighten it out. I'll make amends. He's like, no. You've done enough. You've done enough this week. Just hang tight. And I waited. And in 1999, I got a call. She was in the hospital. She was dying of cancer. She'd had breast cancer about 15 years earlier, had treatment. It was clear for 15 years, but now there's a spot in the liver. There's a spot by the spine, and it's metastasized. It's in her blood system. So she's not going to be with us that long. So I drove to Vegas, and I went to see her in the hospital room, and I made amends. And I talked a little, and I listened a lot. You know. And I remember when my mom was getting ready to die, she was going through this hospice thing, and I was wondering, like, what do I do? What do I do? And a few years earlier, Bill's father, Gordon, passed. And I remember Bill told me, you go there and you brush their hair, you brush their teeth, you change their diaper like she did for you. So that's what I did, because that's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And before my mom died, she called my brother and my two sisters in, and she said, and I'm the youngest. I am the literal black sheep of the family. I was the bad child. I was the bad seed. And before she died, she called my brother and my two sisters in, and she said, if you need anything, you see Steve. He'll take care of it. Now, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and when she passed, I was able to be there. I did the memorial service. I spread her ashes. And as she was getting ready to die, one of the things that was kind of interesting that happened is my sister Vic was down from Idaho, and she was there with her significant other, John. And John and I had been to meetings in Idaho several times, and he had at the time more time than me, or so I thought. But on that particular Christmas in 1999, I noticed he was drinking. He was drinking wine. And he announced to the family that he had gone to a doctor, and he had ascertained through the doctor's advice that he had just had this simple chemical imbalance, and he'd fixed it up, and he could now drink like a gentleman. So you know how I'm watching it, right? You know, I'm like watching this guy, right? And my sister Vic, she puts her wine glass down. She loses track of the wine glass, and because I'm paying attention, I'm like, Vic, it's right over there. I know exactly where everything is, right? John never loses track of his wine glass. In fact, before it gets even halfway empty, he's got to fill it up again, and he's got to fill it up to the extent that he's got to lean over and, because you don't want to spill any of the nectar of the gods, right? So I call Michael. I'm like, Michael, John's drinking. So this is, I don't know what's going on. He goes, it's none of your business. It's none of your business. Maybe you can help him. Maybe you can't. But, you know, by the way, you haven't made amends to Vic yet. So at some point in time, you know, this may come up. Well, it did. It came up about 2 months later. I got a call. Most of us have had those calls. It's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It takes me a couple minutes to realize it's my sister, because all I can hear is crying and snot. And after a couple minutes, Vic tells me that John has found it necessary to put a gun in his mouth and blow his brains out. And he's done it in the living room while she and her daughter are in the bedroom. And I'm like, you know, Vic, I don't know what was going on with John, but if he's an alcoholic of my variety, he's selfish and he's self-centered, and this had more to do with him than it had to do with you. I said, I love you. I'll be up there, you know, because I can handle some of the legal stuff that was going to definitely occur. And I told her, I said, there's this organization I know about. It's called Al-Anon. And they're kind of interesting. They follow us everywhere we go. They really do. And I don't like to lord it over them, but really they would not have a reason for existence were it not for us, really. But they're really good. They're really good. And they're somebody, let me hook you up with some people to talk to in Al-Anon up in Idaho. And I was able to do that and make amends for my sister, both doing some of the legal stuff, but kind of hooking her up with Al-Anon, you know. And that got me and my sister very close. You know, when my stepdad died, we were there, we were co-executors. And it was good. But like I said, these don't always work out well. My brother Tom didn't go well. My brother Tom was a great athlete and a great guitar player in high school. We were in Vegas, and when people wouldn't show up on the strip at the age of 15, he would go down and play sets for them. I mean, he was unbelievable. He was getting paid a lot of money. And the other thing that was going on was he was quite an athlete, and he's 3 years older than me, and all the women liked him, and I'm the little brother. Oh, look at cute little Stevie. So I was getting the runoff from my brother, you know, and this was kind of a good deal. This is a good deal for me, right? And then my brother, there's nothing wrong with this, but my brother really found Jesus. I mean, he literally, you know, conversion, he had one of those Road to Damascus experiences. Within 2 days, he met this woman that God told him to marry. 2 days later, he got married to her. Seems crazy to me, but he's been married for like 45 years now. So, I mean, this guy's, but I'm like the spawn of the devil, right? You know, I'm I'm an alcoholic.
I'm a Green Beret, you know,
and my job description was in special forces, what we do, it's kind of like the Peace Corps, but with guns and bombs. Okay. And what we do is we go to strange and exotic lands and we meet strange and exotic people and we teach them how to kill each other. And it's not classroom instruction. So this is not fitting with my brother's idea, right? So I go to make amends to my brother, and my brother kind of really, he won't even talk to me. You know, he'll say a couple things, but you know, how's the weather, that type of stuff, but we're not really having a conversation. And I want to get a result. And I'm talking to Michael about it, I'm talking to Scott about it, and Scott tells me, he says, have I told you about my brother Mitchell? I said, no. He says, my brother Mitchell won't even talk to me. At least Tom will talk to you. And then he said to me, have you ever considered the possibility that your brother's concept of you, his perception of you, whether it's right or wrong, is such that ongoing close contact with you is more injurious to him than not? Have you ever considered the possibility that maybe your amends to your brother would be to leave your brother alone? Actually, no, I've never considered that, because what I want is my brother back. And I had to pray and meditate about it, and Scott was right, and that's what I've come to realize, and I'm available. And it's not that we hate each other, but, you know, I've had more intimate conversations with a bunch of you than I've had with my brother in 20-some-odd years. We just don't have that relationship. You know, I'm available should it come up, but we don't have that relationship. And this is a process. It's a process of transformation. You know, some of them are kind of weird. One of the risks of being a sponsor is that some stuff comes up that you might have forgot. I remember I was listening to a Fifth Step and a guy is telling me about a little insurance fraud. And I'm like, oh man, I did that. I'd forgotten about it. It wasn't like I tried to omit it from my image. It just didn't come up. What had happened was when I got out of Ranger School, I went to see my girlfriend and I might have possibly sideswiped a couple things on both sides of my car. So I reported it that it was sideswiped. Now, I don't know how you get sideswiped on both sides of your car, okay? But that's what I reported. My insurance carrier was USAA at the time because I was in the military. I was in the Army. They said, they'll take care of it. I go off to Korea. They fix my car. I come back. My car is fixed. No problem. I go through my life, and many, many years later, I get sober. This doesn't even come up, right? Now I realize, oh, man. So I talked to Michael, I got to make amends. I call USAA. It's been several years, and I talked to the first person on the phone, and they're like, they can't figure this out. They're like, wait a minute, let me get a supervisor. No problem. I get a supervisor, I explain the whole thing to the supervisor, and he says, okay, you understand that we've already discontinued your insurance, right? Yeah. He goes, so you're not carried by us at all, right? Yeah, I understand that, because I got the DUI, so they dropped me. And he said, so what you're telling me is you want us to go through the time and effort to create a file so that you can give us, you know, a few thousand dollars so that you can clean up some stuff or maybe feel better. And I'm like, yeah, and this isn't my idea, by the way. You know, I mean, he hung up on me. He hung up on me. So I've been taught like one amends per customer, right? They may throw you out of the office, all right? Like, so I'm good, right? So I go to Michael, I go like, I did it. And he said, no, hung up. So I'm done, right? He goes, yeah, absolutely, no problem. It's, you know, one amends, you don't have to accept your amends. And then he said, and by the way, if you knew, if your sponsor ever says this, run for cover. He says, but you know. And whenever they say, but you know, you clearly don't know, right? He says, but you know, if you really want to be spiritual about this, this isn't your money, right? Well, not technically, no. I mean, you know, they fix it. So if you really want to be correct about this, you know, you want, maybe donate this to a charity or something else, because it's not your money. I'll get back to you. You know, so I'm like, all right, I'll do it. I'm going to donate to a charity. I figured out what the amount is. I'll donate to a charity. He goes, but you know. I'm like, no, I don't know. He goes, you know, if you really want to be spiritual about this, since it's not your money and you're going to donate to a charity, but it's not your money, you really shouldn't take a tax deduction because it's not really your money, right? Okay, all right, I'll do that, right? So I'm ready, I'm doing that. And then he goes, And you know, and I'm like, oh, no, 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 just get it out. Just tell me, whatever it is. I don't know anything. Just tell me. He says, you know, if you really want to be spiritual about this, you can talk about this later, but for the first year or two, you shouldn't mention this to any of your sponsees. Like, I don't mind being spiritual, but I want to get credit for it. You know, I want to get credit for it. This is just too harsh. It's just too difficult. You know. I want to end with this. You know, we were talking about this earlier. Meister Eckhart once said, "The path of which I have spoken is beautiful and pleasant and joyful and familiar." It's familiar. We know it. It's our true self. It's our inner self. It's what Richard Rohr calls the true self. It's the person that we were before we started doing what we did. And Eckhart also says, God does not ask anything else of you except that you let yourself go and let God be God in you. Because we all know, as the big book tells us, the great reality is deep within. It's within me and it's within you. And as you're thinking about these amends, I want to leave you with a Celtic blessing. There's a guy named John O'Donohue. He wrote a book called Adamkara. And Adamkara in Celtic is soul friend. Soul friend. And here it is. May you be able to journey to that place in your soul where there is great love, warmth, feeling, and forgiveness. May this change you. May it transfigure that which is negative, distant, or cold in you. God bless you guys.